Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a spectacular show for you this evening. General Aviation's favorite psychotherapist, Joe Lee Lucas, is here, and we are going to do a deep dive into the psychology of aviation decision making. I cannot wait for this. So let's get to it as soon as possible. Before we get started, just a few things. First of all, things are booming in Social Flight as fall flying approaches or is actually already here. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations, so many missions, so many cool places to fly, and you just have to go and check it out for yourself. It is all free to support General Aviation and supported by our partners, as you see here behind me. And we even have some new stuff. We've got our new Destination Digest, which is an email that you can receive, and a destinations feature built into the website and the app with thousands of destinations with photos and ratings and crew car information, all sorts of cool stuff that we have been working on for over a year collecting and working on all this data. It's just awesome to see the cool places to fly. We've got our Fly to Win challenge. We just gave away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument. And on October 1st, really coming up soon, we are about to give away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. And all you need to do is get the mobile app and check in at your local airport. Even checking in once gets you entered in to win from this prize drawing. And if you go and you fly to many different destinations and events, check in at those and get onto our leaderboard, you get extra entries. And so lots of fun stuff happening there. And our new show, Cockpit to Cal, with Brian Schiff and myself, is also happening. That next show is going to be on Tuesday, October 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern. So just a ton of stuff going on, and I cannot wait to share all of that with you. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Avemco Insurance. I have to tell you, Social Flight has now partnered with Avemco to promote aviation safety, kicking off our work together with tonight's show with Joe Lee Lucas. Avemco is dedicated to education and making flying safer for everyone. And I would just like to a shout out and special thanks to Marcy Veroni and Megan Thomas at Avemco for making all of this possible. If you look around the aviation landscape, if you look at the work that they are doing, it is amazing how many things they are behind that support education and increasing aviation safety. It really is a dedication from them. And you can look forward to some truly amazing new content from Social Flight as we dive into our work together. So thank you again to Avemco for that. Now to tonight's guest. Joe Lee Lucas has dedicated her life to supporting general aviation safety through the application of her unique skills as a psychotherapist to help people understand the mind of the pilot and how we can redefine how we think about aviation safety. As a Mooney over owner and an instrument rated pilot, she understands what it's like to be in the left seat, and her compassion for both pilots and also for passengers helps her skill as an education writer, and you may see her from presentations and things like that. It helps people understand themselves as well as they actually do their aircraft and the airplanes that they fly. And so that makes aviation safer for everyone in the process. Joe Lee has won the AOPA Joseph Crotty Award for GA Advocacy and is a vice president for the California Pilots Association, traveling coastal California and beyond with her Mini Golden, also named Mooney. I am thrilled to call her a friend and to have her here with us tonight here on Social Flight Live. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Joe Lee Lucas. Hey, Joe Lee, how are you doing tonight?
Hey, it's great to see everybody and to see you.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. I sincerely, I mean, we've been friends going back a long time, and I also am one of your biggest fans. I really, really am thrilled with the work that you're doing, and just want to say both a personal and an industry thank you to you for everything that you do.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be on Social Flight Live. I think that what you've done for our community, especially starting during the pandemic and giving us quality education, and as well as to go from the scattered community to the gathered community once a week, is just fantastic. So kudos to you.
That's very, very kind of you to say, and I like the scatter to gather. That's going to be something new in my lexicon. So, Julie, I want to start for the rare person who may be sitting at home tonight that's not really familiar with you, with understanding a little bit about your background and what brought got you involved in aviation, and then also what had you connect the dots between that and your profession to, bring all of this possible and to all of us.
Well, I was an airport kid. My dad was a trainer in World War II and the steerman at Rankin Field in Tulare. Took my mom on a date and took her in the steerman, and when she could handle some aerobatics, he knew she was the one. And so we always had a very modest car, but we had a little airplane in the hangar. And so for us Lucases, it was our station wagon that took us to Seattle and Indiana and Texas, where we had relatives and loved ones. And so it was an airport day in, I guess it would have been 2002, I'm thinking, that my brother flew in his Bonanza, and my dad flew in his Mooney, and we were up at Jackson Westover, which is my home drum for my parents. And I thought, what is wrong with this picture? I didn't have, my certificate, although I really enjoyed flying. And so I decided to contact my local flight school in Hood River, Oregon. That was in July, and I had my certificate in September. And so it just is this love of flight that was instilled in me from my dad. A great appreciation for my mom being in the back seat of a Mooney, because my brother was typically in the front. Sometimes I was up front, and she was dealing with us kids. And so, I had been a psychotherapist for many, many years, and as well, I taught community education. I taught at the community college as well. I taught diagnosis for the Graduate School of Social Work in Sacramento. So I had a lot of experience with adult learners. And when I decided to get my pilot's license, AOPA was offering something called a seminar in a box. And so you paid $25 and they sent you all the materials for a continuing education night. And so I started teaching those with my CFI. And so that got me into the aviation field. And then it just sort of went on from there, where, I'm preaching to the choir with those of us that are so crazy about aviation, and that's what we think about and dream about. And so I wanted to help educate pilots, and as well, it gave me a lot of great experience. So that's
Wow.
sort of the long explanation.
Not at all. Now, was when you got started, like when you have your earliest memories, was that with the Mooney back then?
My dad had a Blanca,
Ah.
867-89er. And so we were in the Blanca for many, many years. And in the 70s, we were in Southern California near Palm Springs. And there was a school district called Perris, Perris. And instead of having an auto shop, they restored a Mooney. And so my dad bought that Mooney. And that was Maggie One, our 1963 C model. And I just remember it was quieter than the Blanca and it was faster. And so a lot of time spent in Maggie taking us across the country and watching my dad and his skill. He made it look very, very easy. and mm-hmm. I always felt safe. I was 17 years old before I flew commercially, and I did not like that I did not know the pilot and whether he fought with his wife or had a drink or I don't know what. You know, it was like, this is not my dad.
I also like that you mentioned, I mean, that that your mom was in the back. It is so true. I mean, we all owe so much to all of the mothers that spend their time in the back seat. That's right. What I think.
That's right. God bless her.
it's such a common thing. So when you decided to go through flight training, can you tell me a little bit about what your experience was like with that and how it was influenced by your interest in learning and how people learn and the psychology of that? Because I have to imagine that your lens of doing that must have been just a little bit different than the rest of us.
That's a great question. I think that I think about thinking a lot. And so as a therapist, you're always listening and taking things in, but you're thinking about the context of what people are saying. And then as a teacher in the community, I tend to be, you know, I wanted my classes to be excellent. And so as a student, I wanted my education to be excellent. And so learning to fly in the Columbia River Gorge was a challenge, not only because of mountain flying being at the base of Mount Hood, but as well our winds. So it was 18 gusts and 26 on my check ride day for my private. And my commercial, as a matter of fact. So, I know what kind of a learner I am, and that comes from my education and my experience teaching. And I think that's important for people to know, whether you need a teacher that's more direct, whether you need a teacher that is more warm and maybe empathetic. And so I also recognize the differences between males and females, with females using five words to one word that a male says. So there's a very, you know, different aspect with that as well. One funny thing is I remember my first lesson in the 152, and my instructor's name is Annie, and she was awesome. And so when you're taxiing, as we all know, you know, you steer with your toes. And so I was making these, you know, sort of like S turns, because I had never really taxied a plane. I'd flown a lot when we were up, and she goes, "I just love how you're making these S turns and getting a feel for the airplane." And I thought, great save. I remember it to this day. So it was one of those great memories.
I love that. There's, you know, it's funny because I think back on the instructor that I had, my primary instructor, who was a very kind of like sort of crusty, tough guy that was a state trooper and did this, you know, privately on the side. And yeah, like would just the way he said things, kind of what you just said reminded me of it. I remember one time we were doing night takeoffs and touch and goes. And as we're going down, like the plane's not lifting off. And he just leaned over and just said to me, "So you're going to raise the flaps?" Like, and like nothing else, like no panic, nothing at all. Just calm. Tell me a little bit about when you think about like learning styles or even men versus women or this whole aspect, that idea of letting people learn things for themselves a little bit. She made a comment, like you just said, that was almost like a little side note kind of thing of letting you see things versus constantly like telling someone the answer, what to do. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think that a person, an instructor that barks at a client, sorry, I've worked all day, student, I'm in client mode. An instructor that barks at a student is much more likely to get a low brain response from that student. And one thing we know about that low brain that we share with other mammals is we get a choice of fight, flight, or freeze. Typically freeze if you're talking about, you know, just barking at a student or telling them everything they're doing wrong. in order to make good decisions in the plane and to be able to have a safe relationship, we have to be able to take our thinking up to the high part of our brain that we don't share with mammals, that we can look at. You know, I looked at what she said in many different ways, right? Because I looked at what she said literally, which was ice making S turns, which was accurate. And then she framed it in a way that was safe, like I was doing it on purpose, which allowed me to save a little face. So I think when we're talking about instruction, I think sort of an assertive but empathetic and kind instructor is much more likely to get a response in which I feel safe enough as a student to become a learner. Mm-hmm. Because as a, you know, I was 40. Was I 40 when I got my, no, yes.
You're still 40. Not 40, Jolie. You can move on.
I know. I'm 22 in my head. So I was, you know, I was used to teaching at a graduate level. I was used to presenting. And so I had to put myself in the space where I was learning. And I think that instructors can really foster a situation in which we feel safe enough to say that we don't know. An example is my flight instructor for my instrument and my commercial, Mike Jesch, who's a master CFII and a very good friend of mine. And yeah, I remember I learned to fly IFR and steam gauges in the LA basin, because why wouldn't you learn to fly instruments in the busiest airspace probably in the country? And he said, you know, where are we? And I'm looking at, the gauges and kind of going like, you know, I know I'm on a radial off the paradise, VOR, you know, but I really don't know where I am. And in order to do that, I had to feel safe enough to tell him I don't know where we are. And so with the instruction that I received from Mike, when we were at the end getting ready for my check ride, he goes, where are we? And I rattled off exactly what radio we were on, how many miles out. And it was because, you know, I was giving myself the ability to be a learner. He was being very patient with me, and it was a successful experience. So I think that when we're looking at decisions in our lives, we need to recognize, am I making this decision out of fear, or am I making this decision out of wisdom? With, you know, if even picking a flight school or deciding if you're going to launch that day, or if you've got a maintenance issue and you're trying to decide, do I fix something or not fix something? I would much rather be making that decision from the high part of my brain, which is like my internal CEO that goes, if I do this, well, this could happen. And if I choose this, that might happen. And if I do nothing, this might happen. Versus fight, flight, or freeze.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Well, you've opened the door. So let's start talking about pilot decision making. And I'll tell you, you know, one of the, it's, I want to start asking you a question about who we kind of are as a group of pilots, because I find it that there's this fascinating tension that on one end of the spectrum, as pilots, we are expected to be confident. We are expected to fly the aircraft at all costs, to never give up on this, to be an expert in order to have people rely upon us and to have the confidence to do things, to stay ahead of the aircraft, et cetera. And then you've got this idea that a good pilot's always learning, all the things we've always been taught, you know, you're always supposed to be learning. And somehow, in that environment of everything we read and everything we're told, we still seem to be a group that I will point at myself and everyone and all these people I've met that has a hard time with change, that has a hard time with thinking of things differently, which is what learning is. So tell me, what is going on with who we are first?
Well, I think that we are habitual thinkers. And so we like to think about things the way we've always thought about things. And so I liken it to you're going you know, I live in the at the beach in California, so we have lots of trails and hiking and such. And so you think about, am I going on this trail, and I'm going to choose the trail where it's pretty well worn. I know where the boulders are. I know what the view is going to look like. And so I'm going to go down that well-worn path. And I believe that what we do with our thinking is we go down the well-worn path. Mm-hmm. If you think about, you know, if I'm at Big Sur, am I going to go on the well-worn path, or am I going to sort of grab something and start going through the trees and the brush? And as thinkers, we like to think about things the way that we've always thought about things. And so that's where we get into trouble with, we don't have this neural plasticity, the ability to take new information in and think about things in a new way. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to say about what you said, and I love that you're self-effacing about it and that you admit that, you know, sometimes you make errors and such, is that about 7% of the pilot population is female. The way that we're organized with our brain and with our personalities is around connection. So that's probably why Annie said, it's so great that you're doing these S turns to get the feel for the airplane, because we were connecting. Most men are organized around wanting to be competent, to know the procedure, the drill, the checklist. I want to be seen as correct and knowing what to do and knowing what's in front of me and saving face. So automatically that puts learning in a different light, doesn't it? If you don't want to admit that you're wrong or that you can look at something differently, then you're going to have problems with habitual thinking, because we're going to think about something the same way that we always have. And the brain is a meaning-making machine. Our brains are totally scanning all the time, trying to make meaning out of things, trying to have a story about something. And so, I don't know if you can hear my dog Mooney, but he just let out a little bark. Sorry about that if you did hear it. So the brain is trying to make meaning. It's trying to create a story that supports our behavior. And so the most that we can do, in my opinion, is start to realistically look at our thinking and see if we can take new information, not think about it the way that we did in 1985, and think in new ways. So in relation to what you're saying, it would make sense that that male pilots want to be seen as competent and knowing what the procedure is, and that they can do things and that they have confidence. It reminds me of a study from many years ago where at a gas station, they set up interviews with people that were at the gas station, and what they were asking for was directions to a fictional place. So the place did not exist. And so, you know, back in the day before GPS and such, so we nowadays this might not work, but 72% of the males gave directions to a fictional place, whereas the females are like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
I think they still will.
right.
Yeah. It seems to me, even if I look at my own instincts, I look at those of other folks that I've talked to, that there's a couple different roadblocks that seem to be in the way. One is to new education, to looking at things differently, to doing things a little bit differently. One is what you just said, which is this huge resistance to failure, to resistance to going up. I mean, as someone says, hey, I have this new buddy, flight instructor, is absolutely fantastic, going to be in town. You can learn a ton from him. He's offering to go up with you for free. Like, there's a certain amount of, he's going to find a bunch of things I do that he doesn't like, that's wrong. There's a certain resistance to failure. And then there's another resistance to change, that maybe I'm going to be shown things to be done differently, and they're going to be right, and I still don't want to change. Tell me about that.
Well, let me ask you a question, since you've been asking me questions. Are you the same pilot that you were when you got your private pilot certificate?
Oh, God, no. If that were the case, I'd have nothing to write about in my columns.
Right. So when we're looking at that first order thinking, which is based on the past, tends to be emotional, and it tends to be disorganized thinking. It's not the most logical thinking. We have to be aware that I'm not the same parent to my third child as I was to my first child. I'm not the same pilot. Many things are the same for me, but I'm not the same pilot that I was when I first learned to fly in Hood River, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is appreciate personal growth. What a concept, right? That we become better versions of ourselves, and that we are willing to be learners and to see if we can do something to make our life a little easier. Does that make some sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And you know, one of the things I have found to be helpful, and that may also be a different way of thinking of things, is when you grant yourself the confidence to say, I'm the ultimate decision maker in this, that I can listen to this. I can have someone else take me up and show me something. I don't have to accept it. I can weigh the parts I thought that were good, the parts I thought that weren't, incorporate it, makes it. The threat level seems to go down internally because the pressure goes down. I don't have to actually accept everything. Does that resonate?
It does, because what you're talking about is going from the lower part of our brain, the amygdala, about the size of an almond, kind of behind our ears, that controls that fight, flight, and freeze. And the difference between taking it upstairs to your, you know, prefrontal cortex and the front of your brain that pushes your, you know, your forehead out. And up there, I can see that somebody might know something that I don't know, or they might know something that's easier, and that I don't have to throw out all of my training or all of my, I call it practice wisdom, because with so many hours of flying, you have things that you have what I call hidden gems and pucker factors. And so when we're able to be in the high part of our brain, I can see you as a colleague, as a mentor, as a teacher, instead of a threat. Mm-hmm. So, and that's that second order thinking. We haven't talked much about it, but second order thinking is reality based, and it takes new information and it challenges you to think about something in a new way. The minute somebody says, I have nothing to learn, I'm like, really? I mean, I surprise myself all the time and I learn new things, and it is physically, it can be a little on the painful side because we're sort of doing that bushwhacking instead of going down that well-worn trail. We're paving a new way in which you and I have more together than we ever would have apart. And I do believe that as GA pilots, whether you're CFI or not, we have a duty to talk with other pilots, to offer advice, support, camaraderie, mm-hmm. information to one another, because it's really hard to say, you know, I need a little help here. Does that make sense?
So why is it so painful? Why is it really a painful thought for some scenario where someone comes and shows you something, teaches you something, provides you something that causes you to realize that you should change something for your personal benefit? Why is that so painful? Why does that seem like a painful thing?
If you think about, I will answer that. If you think about the low part of the brain, always scanning for risk, where's the danger? Where's the risk? You know, maybe I got bit by a dog when I was 5 years old, and that was a while ago, like 17 years. And you didn't get the joke, or at least you didn't smile, Jeffrey, gosh. But so if I were to keep that belief that all dogs are not safe and that I got hurt and I always have to be scanning for who's got their dog on a leash or what's going on with dogs, then I am always going to be on high alert when there is a dog in my area. And what it doesn't do is take new information that I'm not 5 years old, that many dogs are friendly. I got bit and I lived through it. But it's hard to get that lower part of your brain to think anything other than what it wants to think. And so what I talk about is the magic 6 to 8 seconds, which is you can have your reaction. You know, there's a dog, but I'm going to breathe and relax and calm down and take it to the high part of my brain and respond from there. So I might react from the low brain, which we want. If a kid's running out in the street, we don't want to think about the trajectory of the kid and how fast I'm going. And if I brake now, how long is my skid going to be? We want to slam on the brakes, right? But when it's a situation in which it is not very dangerous, it's not dangerous to learn something new. Uh-huh. It's not dangerous to say, I need help. I didn't fly myself to Oshkosh because I had a death in my immediate family. And I knew that I was not able to fly. Could I have flown? Yes. I mean, I have all the skills. I have the airplane. Is it a wise decision for me to be up in an aluminum can at 13,000 feet, you know, flying across the country and being alone? No. And so I had people at Oshkosh say, you didn't fly yourself? And I said, no, I had a death in my family and I'm not well enough to fly. And they're like, oh, it would be good for you. So that's first order thinking, right? Mm-hmm. That in the past, that person who said that to me got stress relief from flying. Okay. So, you know, you have a rough day at work and you go flying and you see the sunset and stuff is good, right? Second order thinking is there's somebody in front of you that's being vulnerable, that's saying they're not well enough to fly. And I don't need somebody to, you know, I need understanding because that's a vulnerable place.
Yeah.
So I think that second order thinking is what allowed me to, you know, have United take me to Appleton. And I stand by that decision.
Absolutely. No question about it. It's fascinating to me how in general aviation, there's so many things that are about safety. There's so many things that keep us so focused on this. And like I said in the beginning, education is in our face. And yet we seem as an industry to have a really hard time evolving. We really do in any possible way. When I see things on the maintenance side, right? When there's new technology that comes out, it's easy with avionics, but when there's a new way of thinking about maintenance or a new thing you should be doing, or we've learned something that actually you shouldn't do this or you should do this, people have a very, very hard time and really don't want to do it differently. And yet in a field like you're in, it seems like in the medical profession, they're always looking to an understanding that the state of the art is always changing.
Yeah.
And that there doesn't seem to be as much of a firm white knuckle grip on doing things the way we used to. So what are your thoughts on that? And how, I know you're a champion of change for that. What are your thoughts on it? And how do we change it?
Well, I think talking about it's the first thing where we're able to say, you know, I don't want to change my opinion about this, or I'm not sure about this new technology. You know, I like paper charts or whatever it might be. Or one for me is, I don't think that pilots do a very good job assessing their readiness to fly. Because I talk about things that people don't talk about sometimes, which is mood, anxiety, loss, stress, burnout, grief. What's your energy level like? I know it sounds strange, but I ask people about their sex drive. Mm-hmm. Because if we're looking at all of those things, then I'm assessing as a human being, am I well enough to fly? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we do a very good job of that as pilots looking at ourselves. When I teach Right Seat Ready, which is the companion seminar that I teach around the country, I work with companions on how do you talk to your left seat pilot about any concerns that you might have, or how does your left seat pilot speak with you about concerns? If we're not growing, we're going back. We all know people that are stuck in their thinking, stuck in the mud, and it's their way or the highway. And I feel bad for that because life is so short. And it really comes down, in my opinion, to who you love and who you're loved by. My aviation family has been incredible to me, and I try to give them all of my heart and soul and education and all that. But until we make it a colleague talking to a colleague or a mentor talking to a mentor, where we feel like we can make mistakes, we can evolve, we can change our thinking. Again, that comes from that really high part of the brain that says, again, you are not a threat to me. That ancient part of the brain is always looking for, like, you know more than me, so you're more competent than I am. And so I think that's difficult. You talked about the medical model and working as I do in mental health. There are some people that are really stuck in the ways that they used to treat clients or patients, and they don't necessarily like the new technology. But I think our bedside manner, if you want to call it that, can evolve. So that if I'm flying with somebody and I really don't understand what they're doing in the plane, not a safety issue, but just like, what are they doing? I might say something like, hey, Jeffrey, can you tell me you're thinking about this? Because I want to understand.
And I'll turn over to you and I'll go like, nope, no idea.
I have no thinking about it. It's on autopilot. Come on, Jolie. So, right? Because that's an invitation for me to tell you about my process. And it doesn't have to, this is not a competition, folks.
Yeah.
It's we're really all in this together.
Is there some benefit then to the idea of practicing those experiences, kind of exercising the muscle of learning something that and challenging something that's out of your way of doing things? Let me give you an example of where I'm coming from, because this may sound strange, but when I think back on the things that I've learned the hard way from, strangely, the biggest one was a case where I ended up canceling a trip that I was really, really wanted to go, really thought I was going to make it happen. It had to do with getting home, and literally was struggling, trying to justify going, and finally made the decision to stay overnight where I wasn't planning on it, and all the trouble and embarrassment and everything that went with it. And the next morning found out, and it was due to weather, and the next morning found out that someone had died trying to get into that airport, that there had been an accident. And it was this case where I actually, for this, kind of looked at and said, I actually chose not to go, as opposed to all these cases of I learned about flying from that, I barely survived this, all the mistakes I'd made. I actually had this one time where I did things right once, and thought, wow, I actually exercised this thing and feel better the next day for having done it, even though it kind of hurt at the time.
Yeah.
Is there a way we can kind of practice this for people, or people can push this so we get more comfortable with it?
Yes, is the short answer. And we have to remember about practice, that practice doesn't make perfect. practice makes practice, and through practice we gain mastery. And so when you're talking, that was a perfect example of first order thinking and second order thinking, where you're like, but I really want to go, but I think I can do that. And that's that reaction from the lower part of the brain. And something in you took it to that higher part where you're thinking, okay, what's the wise thing to do? I could do this, I could do that, I could rent a car, I could commercial, whatever it might be. And that you ended up making the choice that was correct for you. I want to talk a tad bit about simulators, because I think they're a wonderful way to practice scenarios. Again, it's great to practice in an airplane. It's not always feasible for everybody to go up and practice in their plane or rent a plane, but our simulators give us practice and practice. And then we add, you know, something new, where you've got a ceiling or you've got a wind that changes, which is new information. And we're able to practice those scenarios. One of the things that I talked to my right seat ready people about when I was in Texas recently is that lots of times I had them on a Redbird simulator practicing landing in Texas. And so they're looking at the runway and they're wanting to land on the runway. And so we talked a little bit about landings are optional. That part of our brain is, see that runway? That's where I'm landing. That's all there is to it. I'm going to keep on this approach, even though I'm not stabilized, et cetera. And so it's really second order thinking to go, nope, I'm going to go around, or I'm going to go to my alternate, or I'm just going to circle and get, you know, my brain to catch up with me. So what we're talking about here is the ability to practice. I can only practice if I feel safe. I felt safe enough to tell Mike Jesh, I don't know where the heck we are. I mean, my airplane's under control. I've had her for 20 years. I know her like the back of my hand, but I couldn't tell you, you know, how far out on the Paradise VOR was.
So maybe that same concept applies with your partner or your passengers or someone else, that there's this idea of acceptance and respect for getting all the way out to the airport, looking at the winds or something, and just being like, I'm going to call it, or vice versa.
Yeah. Or you don't feel right. You didn't sleep well, or you're super stressed out. You drank too many Red Bulls, et cetera. You know, we have to have the ability to be flexible. And again, I know I keep talking about it all night, but we really don't like to do that. We really like to think we have the same way we've always thought. And so if I only had one thing to say to folks, it would be there's a lot of freedom in growth and in connection and in change, because that's from the wise mind. You know, we've got this emotional mind and, you know, and our sort of logical mind. Where they come together is the wise mind. I don't want to be completely illogical. But I don't want to be an automaton that, well, I've said I'm on final and I have to land here, even though I don't want to. So we do need our emotions in there. A lot of times when something's going on, we get a hunch, we get a feeling, something doesn't feel right. We have to pay attention to that.
Yeah. So can you kind of break it down for some of us here in how you feel like we as pilots should approach decisions? Like, is there some type of we think in checklists, right? We're pilots. Is there some type of a thing that we can think about that can question our normal and change our normal reactions to doing things?
You know, I developed this presentation series based on an article called Into the Alligator's Mouth, The Psychology of Personal Flight Guidelines. And I interviewed Brian Schiff, and I don't think he would mind that I'm mentioning him. And he said that at the beginning of his career, he didn't ever want to cancel a flight. You know, you have this sort of mission mentality, and that where he is now in the past many years is like, I almost look for a reason to do the flight, right? Because you've got to consider yourself, your airplane, your environment, and all of that stuff. So I think that what I would suggest to folks is to continue with any continuing education opportunities that are available, whether it's online, in person, and challenge yourself to try to look at something from someone else's point of view, because that's the mental gymnastics that we have to do to have thinking that is reality-based. So we have, let's say on the ground, we're doing our strategic planning. When I fly to Oshkosh every year, typically, you know, I do my planning. I know where I'm going to stop. I know where the courtesy cars are, where the best steak is in Texas, all those good things. So that's my strategic planning. But then when I'm in the air, it's a tactical situation where it's like, yeah, you know, you can't land there. There's no fuel. There's a thunderstorm. You know, somebody hit an animal on the runway. That runway's not available. So we have to look at, but wait, I plan to go to Borger, Texas. Somebody said I didn't say Borger right when I was in Texas, so I can't remember how you're supposed to say it. But you know, that first order thinking is like, wait, I'm going to the, you know, Rosa, Texas Steakhouse, where they have those awesome steaks and rolls. And with our planning that is in the air, we have to think about, okay, I can't do what I thought I was going to do, so I'm going to do this or this or this. And I love flexible thinkers. I love people that can look at a situation and see that there's a gift in it. There was a gift that you didn't try to get into that airport. And there was a gift that I didn't fly to Oshkosh. Mm-hmm. It was a gift. You know, I didn't have to worry about all those things.
Tell me a little bit about mentorship, because it seems that one of the best ways that when I look back on experiences, it sometimes I needed a little help to get to the right decision. And someone who wasn't as vested or as focused or single-minded as I was on something can look at it and say, no, no, yeah. I know you really want to do this, but no. Tell me a little bit about how that helps us and how we can, more people can employ that.
And let me ask you a question. When you think of a mentor, do you think of a young person or an older person? Just when you think you hear the word mentor.
You know, I think in general, the a normal person might think of an older person here, but I'll be honest with you, in my world, maybe mentor isn't even the right word, but I kind of start to get the board of directors in my world, right? The friends and this group, including yourself, of course, of people I know that I'll call, and they're not always older. I mean, there are many times on something I'll call my son Jake, I'll call Ben, I'll call one of them because I know that in some ways they'll make a better recommendation than maybe I would at the moment.
Especially technology.
Yeah, especially if they want to see their dad again. Yeah. I
think that's a great point, because I think a lot of folks think of an older person, an older pilot, when you think of a mentor or somebody that has more experience. But I do think there is something to be said for our younger pilots. And that's why I interviewed several of them for this article series, because I wanted to hear, when you're at the front end of this, what are your concerns? How do you take care of yourself? I think that we have something to learn from everyone. And what we need to do, in my opinion, is put our ego aside to some bit, to think again that as colleagues, as folks that want to have a happy flying life and a long flying life, that I can learn something from everybody, maybe even somebody I disagree with. That I can take something. I try to find something true about what folks are saying, because then I can join them on that part. And so, you know, I do, when I first got my pilot's license, AOPA had a mentor program, and I had a mentor. He was based in Portland, and of course I was in Hood River, and we would talk about things. I would say, I asked him about my calls and the pattern, if I was phrasing things correctly. I talked about go, no-go decisions, and he was very, very gracious with me. And I think that aspect, I know with the 99s and with women in aviation in particular, that we mentor other females, whether they're becoming mechanics, pilots, aircraft owners, all of that. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe that's a good question for somebody that's as connected as you are. Like, what do you see that where we could increase the ability to connect with folks so that we can make decisions based on wisdom instead of the little reptile brain down at the bottom where we're just wanting to punch somebody or run or freeze?
Yeah, well, you know, it's I love listening to you talk about this, and my brain just keeps racing, and I keep thinking two different things. You know, one, how wonderful would it be to have just more and more resources, right? The type clubs, the numbers you can call, things like that, all the people you can reach out to, and how important it is if you could have access to them more round the clock, you know, when you need it, at that moment when you're making a critical decision. And then the other part, which is the idea of having an open mind, as you were talking about, the second order thinking.
Yeah.
That can be framed negatively or positively. Like, it's very easy to talk to say, oh, this person who asks a bunch of people about stuff is wishy-washy. They don't have any confidence. Mm-hmm. They don't know what they're doing. You can put a negative spin on it for yourself even. But there's also that very positive spin. If you know, I know what I'm doing, I'm soliciting more information. And like you said, people you agree with, people you don't agree with, with the idea, though, that you are still absolutely in control. You are still the executive. And you are that much more powerful for picking the gems from a whole group and then making your decision.
And I think learning from someone else's pucker factor. Yeah. I think that learning from other people's pucker factors is nice. That you think, okay, I'm not going to do that. And I do love what you're saying, that if we look at a learner as somebody that's gathering information, we don't want, and my best teachers have been this way, they don't spoon feed me every answer, but they give me ideas where to look and some opinions, and then I decide. Because mm-hmm. we got to be PIC in our life and in the plane. And that's why I like combining, you know, the psychology of life and the psychology of flight together so that we have a healthier life in general. And here comes my cat. So. Oh, Lorelai, I was wondering if you'd wake up. Let me get her over here. She's so adorable. You know, petting cats, purring, petting your dog increases your oxytocin levels, which is a hormone, a chemical in us that makes us feel connected and calm. So if any of you are wondering out there, you know, how can you start your day off a little bit better? It's Lorelai right here and petting her and increasing my oxytocin, my dopamine, my serotonin, all those good things that Absolutely. My brain is floating
and
in.
And then go take a flight.
Right. She's been in the airplane one time. She did not like it. Mooney's a good flyer.
I cannot imagine a cat in an airplane does not sound like a safe situation, at least not free roam. Jolie, listen, it is time. We have reached the point in the show where we do something called Social Flight's Fast Five, which is this fun opportunity for people to get to know Jolie Lucas a little bit different and on a little bit more condensed level. How do you feel about that? You up for it?
I am game.
Excellent. Well, Jolie Lucas, this is your Social Flights Fast Five. 5 questions where people get to know who you are, a little bit more about you and your outlook on flying and life. And so we're going to get started with question number 1, which is, when you think back on all the different trips that you've taken, different cool places that you have gone, what is the first place that pops into mind as this really wonderful experience that aviation brought to you?
Whoa, I've got competing interests. What came to mind first was Alamogordo, New Mexico, and White Sands, and being able to fly in there. It's such an aviation-rich and space-rich area. And then the White Sands, and how it's almost loud how quiet it is. And then what came in right after that is going to the Mooney Factory and flying to Kerrville, Texas, and meeting the people that made my wing and sealed the tanks in my airplane and wired my airplane. And so that comes in a quick second.
That's wonderful. I love that. All right. Question number 2. Was there a particular moment, something either scary or impactful or anything that had to do with your flying that you feel really changed your experience moving forward, that you really learned something dramatically from?
Well, yes, that would be 2003 or 2004. I have a hard time remembering sometime when I was flying with I was left seat, my dad was right seat. My daughter and her boyfriend were in the back seat. It was airport day, Hood River, Oregon, flying to Eugene, Oregon, go Ducks, and taking the kids to college. We lost the number one valve on the number one cylinder, came unseated. And about 150 feet in the air, I had to make a decision as to what we were going to do, because we were headed toward Mount Defiance. So terrain was rising. We were not. We ended up taking out 5 or 6 trees and flipped upside down into a mud pond. And then the trees fell on us. And so that was at 11 o'clock in the morning. I mean, my mom saw us go down. My flight instructor, my DPE, all saw us go down. And by 7 o'clock that night, we were grilling steaks and barbecuing, that none of us were injured. We bumped our heads, but that was okay. I can show you my scar later. But, that having a off airport landing, a crash so early in my flying career changed the trajectory of my flying and my life and my dedication to safety in the airplane, because you think that something you did or did not do caused the crash, which wasn't true. It was a mechanical issue. And I did not try to get back to the airport. We would have stalled and spun and died.
Well, thank goodness it worked out the way that it did. And you're still here for all of us. All of that. Okay, question number 3, and this one's a fun one on a positive note. If you could go back in time to any moment, not to change it, just to spend 15, 20 minutes and get to re-experience something back in your life, what would that be?
Oh, goodness sakes. I think it would be 4th of July in Sutter Creek, California, where you're up at the football field and you have 3-legged races and the egg, carrying the egg on the spoon races, the band's playing. I'm laying, it's a warm summer night in July, looking up at the stars, and then the fireworks go off. I had such a feeling of family and connection and awe. And those things are the 3 things that are most important to me now.
I love that. That is truly, truly wonderful. All right, question number 4. If you could go back in time again now and give some advice to your younger teenager or early 20s self, what would you say?
Well, what comes to mind is stop driving that baby blue Ford Pinto so fast. I think that I would tell my younger self that I need to think of myself first and to have good boundaries, and I can't be all things to all people. I have that ability to try to scan and see how everybody's doing, and sometimes put that in front of me. And even with my education now, it's putting you in front. How am I doing? So I think I would go back and tell her just like, don't drive so fast in your Pinot, and be true to yourself. The worst thing you can ever do is lie to yourself or not be true to yourself.
Wow. Okay, and our last question, the fifth question of Social Flight's Fast Five for the evening. If there was anyone throughout history, history, present, past, for you to spend an evening with, who would that be? Who comes to mind?
What's interesting is it's my dad. You know, he died unexpectedly, and he was my hero in life. And he had a way of making me feel safe, but challenged to always be the best that I could be. And I guess I would just like to be in his presence again.
Mm. That is a very, very wonderful sentiment. And it really, it certainly makes sense, and we're grateful to him for the person he made in you.
Yeah.
Well, Jolie, thank you so, so much for joining us here on Social Flight Live. If you could please let everybody know what's coming up for you, where they're going to get to see you, where they're going to get to read about some of the things that you're doing. There is so much going on, and I want to know it as well.
Okay. So October 9th is our California Zooming, which is our California Pilots Association annual conference. It's virtual. Anybody can join. It's calpilots.org. And we have a lot of great seminars, John and Martha King, Rod Machado, and others. And it's just a lot of fun. It's that community, the education, the camaraderie. Let's see. And so, AOPA in Buckeye, Arizona is coming up Valentine's Day of 2025, and I should be presenting there. And so that's a big hoot. And then Redbird Migration, I will be speaking there and most likely doing my companion seminar called Right Seat Ready, and that is March 4th and 5th. If folks want to connect with me, JolieLucas.com. And I just really enjoyed being here tonight, and I hope that folks can see that thinking in new ways isn't scary. It's actually kind of cool. Keeps us young, right? Like I'm 22, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And I'm so grateful. And of course, all of your appearances, all the different places that you're going to be, are going to be available in Social Flight. So if you want to see all the different events that are out there, they're at socialflight.com or the Social Flight mobile app. We are a huge fan of Jolie Lucas. So all your stuff will always be there.
Thank
all right,
you.
Well, you have thank a you for wonderful, having me. Wonderful evening, and thank you so much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night.
And thanks to all of you for taking time out of your evening to join us here again on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday, September 24th, with Teresa Claiborne, the first female African-American pilot in the United States Air Force, and also a long-haul 787 pilot for much of her career. Just amazing stories. I've spent time with Teresa. She is a spectacular individual, incredibly accomplished, and someone that we can all learn from. And so cannot wait to have her here on the show. And then on Tuesday, October 1st, NFL great Jimmy Graham will be here on the show. He's a pilot and also chairman of the Young Eagles program with EAA. And Jimmy is a lot of fun, and he'll again be here on October 1st, Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon for Social Flight. Blue skies.